Mr. Chief Justice, Your Honors, good morning. And before I begin, I had prepared a PowerPoint presentation, and I know you're all excited to see it, but unfortunately, due to technical difficulties, you will not be seeing that. But if I could, I'd like to hand the printed copies to the marshal for dissemination to the court. I have provided a copy to opposing counsel.
It would have been the first PowerPoint in 10 years for me on the
court.
I'd be very disappointed.
I was all excited, but it is what it is. May I proceed?
You may proceed.
This is a premises liability case. The plaintiff, who is now the respondent in this matter, was an invitee of OOSI, the appellant. She was shot in the appellant's parking lot by her boyfriend and father of her daughter. I'll refer to him as the shooter. Procedurally, she filed suit in Jackson County for her injuries, claiming a breach of a duty to protect her on OSI's premises, the parking lot, from the shooter. She elected at trial to present her claim on one lone theory, and that's what I refer to as the specific harm exception to the no-duty rule, or the SH exception. You all are familiar with the no-duty rule, which is a general rule that says that a business owner is not liable for the criminal acts of third parties committed on the premises, with some limited exceptions. Ms. Weiland was awarded $3.2 million in damages. OOSI appealed to the Western District. That appeal was denied, and this court has granted transfer. Now, there's two main issues. There were several points or claims of error before the Western District, but the two issues here, then the first one is, was the evidence sufficient for the claim to be submitted to the jury under the SH exception? And keep in mind that the respondent made a specific election to proceed on that lone theory, although she had alleged other theories. And the underlying question in that issue about the sufficiency is whether or not under this court's ruling in LAC, or its opinion in LAC, which I believe was decided in 2002, whether or not the SH exception foreseeability test for establishing a duty of care was going to be replaced by a general foreseeability test. And that, of course, would have expanded the liability of business owners in the state, because the SH exception foreseeability test was far more stringent than general foreseeability. And as a practical matter, if you did away with the specific foreseeability test and went to a general foreseeability test, then it's just general negligence. So the no-duty rule would disappear. It would no longer be a part of our jurisprudence in this state, and the liability of business owners all over this state would be affected. They would have much greater exposure under that interpretation of the law. The other issue here is whether or not Ms. Weiland was allowed to argue a breach of duty which was not instructed upon. And by that, although the Western District decided to review some other claim, we said no matter what the substantive law is in this case, regardless of how you determine the first issue, in her verdict director, which is instruction number 6, and we'll look at it in a second, she only alleged one specification of negligence, and that was the failure to call the police in time to have prevented this shooting. She argued a breach of duty for failure to provide precautionary measures that would have detected the shooter sooner and given more time to have protected her from the shooting. Now, with respect to the SH exception, each one of these exceptions that's been recognized by the court as to the no-duty rule has specific underlying facts that must be determined by the jury in order to impose a duty of care on the business owner. And under the theory that the plaintiff or the respondent chose in this case, that duty, and it's our argument, that duty can only arise once the known dangerous person is on the premises, and a person using, or the business using reasonable care and acting diligently could have known of the presence of the shooter in time to have prevented this very tragic accident. So the bedrock of our argument as this first issue is that the only duty and the only facts you can look at is what could the business owner, in this case our client, what could the business owner have known after the shooter came on the premises? Not what the business owner could have done a month before or 2 months before.
But why isn't anything they could have done a month or two before relevant to what's reasonable, what a reasonable business owner would know? And I know you're saying we can't look at whether they failed to tell her about these precautionary measures they could take and so forth. But in deciding what would have been reasonable, why isn't the fact that they had indicated they thought this was a reasonable way to handle these kind of problems relevant?
Right. Your Honor, that's a good question. I'm happy to answer it. Under your jurisprudence, which is LAC, this court has recognized limited liability. And, of course, regardless of what theory or exception you're pursuing a negligence case on, foreseeability is always going to be the test. It's always the bedrock of any test of whether or not a duty of care is imposed upon a business owner or whomever. And in this case, and in the wisdom of the court, because you wanted to give limited liability exposure to businesses, you said as a general proposition, there will be there's no duty of care to prevent criminal acts of third parties from injuring someone. But then the court started saying, look, given a basic foreseeability test, we have to look if there are certain specific special circumstances that could lead to an imposition of duty. And what the court recognized, and the two main ones, the one that we're talking about, the specific harm exception, has to do with the individual, the perpetrator, is known. Whereas the PSI exception, prior similar incidents, it has to be that there were so many crimes committed prior to it. So what you did, or in my opinion, reading LAC, and I think the court will remember that I wrote the opinion for the Western District that ended up to the Supreme Court. You sat on that case, as did Judge Breckenridge. But my point is that you saw fit, and I think rightfully so, that in a specific harm exception, there would be no duty to act, no duty to act prior to entry on the premises. You limited to that. So what do we have here? A business owner has no duty to act until the entry is physically made. Not when they knew about the entry, but when they physically come on the property. And then thereafter, under the circumstances that existed at the time of entry, that you would have known in sufficient time to have taken reasonable steps to prevent the shooting. So under that exception, their election, you have limited liability, and they have to prove those two basic concepts. And if you will look at instruction number 6, which is on your PowerPoint and hard copy, the actual instruction is on page 8, and the blow-up is on page 9. The underlying facts, Judge, SH exception foreseeability test are found in paragraph 1st and paragraph 2nd of that instruction. That's what the jury had to find in order to satisfy the SH exception foreseeability test. And unless and until they did that, there no duty was imposed. And therefore, if there wasn't evidence supporting that, you couldn't submit it. And here's what happened. This is my view. When you look at the language in paragraph 2nd about could knew or by using ordinary care could have known, under the SH exception, and you have to read that in the context of the exception on which the theory or which the case is submitted. You can't look at the universe of theories that could have been submitted in this case. You are limited to the SH exception. And our argument is, when it said could have known, it's not what you could have known if you would have done month before or 2 months, if you would have put in 24-hour surveillance by armed guards, or the fact you'd put cameras that were going to be monitored 24/7.
You know, but you didn't object to this instruction. This instruction doesn't limit the jury to considering what happened in that hour. It says the defendant knew or by using, it's very hard to read, but ordinary care could have known that he was in the parking lot. And wasn't there evidence for, why wasn't it relevant that there was evidence they could have known had they followed their normal procedure?
Right.
And so that's something the jury could consider in that.
You're asking the very question I was just talking about.
Wonderful.
You're interpreting could have known based on anything known prior to entry. And I am arguing that this was not an instruction argument. This instruction is correct. We never claimed instruction error, so we didn't object to the instruction.
Right.
In fact, we were quite pleased that the plaintiff chose to submit on this exception, because we darn well knew there wasn't any evidence within the confines of the SH exception foreseeability test that they could ever get to the jury. Because the problem is, they could never show that on the existing circumstances at his time of entry that they could have known. They had monitors, or cameras, but they didn't monitor them. That's okay. That's what the existing circumstances were. If you do otherwise, and I'm not saying you can't.
So what's the point of having the cameras then?
I can't. I'm sorry.
So what's the point of having the cameras? What's the point of taking any precaution?
I'm not sure, Judge, but here, Mr. Chief Justice, here's the point I'm trying to make. If you're going to say that every business owner in this state, from now and forever, there'll be no more exceptions. We're just going to use a general foreseeability test. And anything within your knowledge, meaning you're going to interpret could have outside the box of the SH exception, and you're going to let any piece of evidence that would have put this business owner on notice that there may be an incident here and you've got to protect against it, then you can do it. Now, I suggest you can't do that to my client because the existing law comes under LAC.
Well, and you're focusing on what they knew. But isn't it really an issue of what ordinary care means? And that Ms. Whelan's arguing that ordinary care would require them to take precautionary measures, and so that if someone had developed protocols, suddenly their standard of ordinary care is much higher than somebody who didn't even think about the issue of protocols.
First of all, Your Honor, with all due respect, I am not focusing on what they actually knew. I am not. As I have explained, it's the interpretation as could have known. Your question indicates that you think that the could have known means the universe of facts before he entered, after, all the universe of the facts. I am arguing that under your law, under the SH exception foreseeability test, you're not allowed to do that.
So focus for a moment on ordinary care. So how do we look at what ordinary care is?
Right. If you want to apply a general ordinary care test here, you can do it. That wasn't the law under LAC. You had taken it out of the realm of general negligence. Your all opinion said no. As a general rule, we're not going to have business owners responsible for the criminal acts of third parties. You decided to bring down the box of the foreseeability test and the underlying facts. And what I'm saying is, if you abide by LAC and my interpretation of it, otherwise there's no need to have these exceptions, just go to general negligence and tell the business community that's what's going to be.
What I'm looking at is your opponent expressly says in the brief that by adopting safety protocols, they established what was ordinary care.
All right, if that's the case, then look at this instruction and show me where they submitted to this jury a theory of negligence based on a breach of the failure to do their protocol. The breach is not there. How can you argue sufficiency of the evidence on a theory not presented? So your question hypothesizes a theory of breach that does not exist in this case.
Mr. Smith, I think that you're hypothesizing a restriction in the instruction that's not there. You're saying that all the evidence that came in that would have gone to the prior incident theory or something else is not relevant to this theory, but there's no limiting instruction, is there? So the jury was free to consider all this.
Your Honor, with all due respect, you're wrong on the facts. They tried to use the PSI exception. They tried, and the trial court excluded all evidence of prior similar incidents.
Whichever exception it was, my point is evidence came in about these safety protocols, right? It was
over our objection because we said it wasn't relevant. And this, of course, goes back to the instruction conference.
My point, counsel, is that the jury was not prohibited from considering that evidence and deciding what's ordinary care and that could have been used by the defendant. So,
with all due respect, Your Honor, the reason why they weren't prohibited from hearing it is because the trial court overruled my objection. This isn't a submissible case. Now, common sense and logic will tell you that if the one party objects that this isn't sufficient evidence to submit it, the jury would have never heard what you said. You're blaming me. Well, the jury heard it.
Well,
sure they did.
I'm asking about if you're saying the jury couldn't consider it here. There's nothing in the instruction that tells them they can't. Was there a separate limiting instruction, or else wasn't it a problem with not objecting to?
With all due respect, Your Honor, I disagree with you that there was nothing limiting from them to do it. Mm-hmm. The could have language has to be interpreted, and the gatekeeper was the trial court. Mm-hmm. And we argued, and you look at we preserve this because you know how much time I spend in preservation. So we told them that evidence, and we objected to the very evidence you're talking about. That evidence goes to the PSI exception. It does not fit the paragraph 1 or 2 because it doesn't come within the box of the SH exception. The trial court listened and said no. So essentially what the plaintiff was allowed to do was to argue an impermissible conjoined theory of liability. And they cobbled together this Frankenstein theory of the SH exception and the PSI exception. And they had to do that for this reason.
Counselor, try to wrap. You're chewing into your rebuttal time. the clock's going up. Just try to.
Can I?
I want you to respond to that.
Okay, thank you. The what they did was, is in the instruction, and we were okay with the instruction, knowing this could have language was within the confines of the SH exception, and we would object to this very evidence. You're saying, well, the jury got to hear it.
I understand your point.
Okay.
Mr. Chief Justice, I have one other question. You talk in your initial brief about a third way to submit the case, and you identify that as assumed duty.
Right.
What's the case source for that third cause of action?
Well, I can't remember, but the reason why I can't remember is because they abandoned that. Of course, it wasn't instructed on.
But that seems closer to they assumed the duty to care for this person by adopting all those protocols.
Yeah, but the problem is they decided not to go to the jury on that theory, so I don't think you can decide this case on a theory that wasn't submitted. It's not
but
the
it was
fact
fled.
They. But they didn't submit. In fact, the record will show they made a conscious election of the theory when they presented.
At the time you're submitting, but at the time all the evidence came in, that evidence was relevant to what they pled, they just didn't later submit.
Again, over our objection. We can't be responsible for the fact the jury was allowed to hear evidence that if this trial judge had not allowed this, in other words, you go back in time, if under our claim of error, if this trial judge had said, Mr. Smith, I agree with you, there's not sufficient evidence to submit on their choice of theories, not mine, and this will never go to the jury, this would have been the end of the case. So my argument to you is, he committed error in not doing what I wanted. So all of these comments or questions about, well, look what happened later, look what happened later. That's what we were trying to avoid. You're almost, it's like you're trying to say you don't get the benefit of the fact this error occurred back here. We're just going to assume this was an error, and so all this applies. And remember, at the end of the day, if the trial court would have done what we said he should have done under this theory, there would have been no trial because their election was to proceed on that. Now, if what the court is suggesting is that a party can elect one theory of a case, we go through the instruction conference and everybody knows the theory, I've got my arguments ready, we get our objections ready, and then somewhere a year later or whatever go, well, how about that other theory? I know they didn't instruct on it, I know they weren't pursuing on that, but you should have done something to stop that. I don't think so, Your Honor, not under the law. So the point is, we believe that this language did constrict the evidence. We believe that the SH exception foreseeability test should apply, and that if it did, there is absolutely no evidence that after he entered the premises, there could have been any action taken by OSI that could have prevented this shooting, because to have prevented it, they would have had to have been able to detect him sooner. And you're right, Your Honor, if they would have had 24-hour surveillance, if they would have had armed guards out there, they would have seen him sooner. But is that the duty you want to impose on the businesses of this state? Because I believe that if you say that a business owner, take my small town grocery store, that if they know that Mr. and Mrs. Jones are getting a divorce and Mr. Jones has threatened Mrs. Jones that he's going to kill her, and they know that Mrs. Jones is going to come to their grocery store every Tuesday at 4 o'clock, because that's what she does, and that he might show up someday, any day, then you better get security out the wazoo, because under this recovery, if you affirm it, that's going to be the duty of businesses in this state. I believe that's a far expansion of liability. And you might as well get rid of the no duty rule. Go to a general negligence. I'm not arguing public policy here. That's for you all to decide. I'm just arguing on behalf of my client that under the law that I defended these people on, this is what it should be. If you want to change it later, that's fine. I appreciate the extra time, Your Honor.
Thank you. Mr. Bethune.
May it please the court. Good morning. I have a handout I'd like to provide the court. Mr. Schumann, with the blow up. I've given you this.
Mr. Bethune, before we get into the facts that you've just handed us, I think you argued in your brief that by adopting safety protocols, the defendant established what is ordinary care.
Yes, Your Honor.
What's the law that supports that?
Well, I believe Mr. Smith was arguing about LAC. And LAC is not the only case that discusses this type of exception to whether a business owner owes a duty to somebody. There is Madden versus C&K Barbecue, which we've cited in our brief. It was a 1988 decision by this court in bank that talks about the totality of the circumstances. And that's what the focus is on these type of cases these days. Not only,
but there's a difference between what are the circumstances and requiring that there was a requirement to protect the victim. You seem to rely in your brief on the, I'm not sure I'm pronouncing it right, the Aziz case.
Yes, ma'am.
In that case, the action that they were found negligent for doing was not addressing the danger. And you're suggesting we need to have the duty of care to require them not to address the danger that was on their property, but instead to protect the victim. And I don't see any cases that have ever required that in the special harm, specific harm exception.
Well, if we look at the exceptions, whether it's the specific harm, whether it's prior incidents, or whether it's a balancing test, all those, I think, under Madden and under LAC, it talks about that we don't need to enter that fray to get any one of those particular tests. But to answer your question, it goes back to the Hoover Dairy case. When if somebody's going to undertake a duty, then they have the obligation to undertake that duty and use ordinary care.
But that's not what you submitted. You didn't submit that they undertook the duty to protect the victim, and therefore they then breached that duty. And that's not what this case is about, but you're taking that concept and you're trying to call that a breach of the duty of ordinary care.
Well, I believe, Your Honor, what we submitted on in instruction number 6, which was just referenced, relates to the exceptions to whether or not a business owner is responsible for third-party criminal acts. And in this case, so to answer your question, we need to look at the specific facts of this case, the unique facts of this case. And we get to the issue of duty. That is a question of law. And the touchstone to duty is foreseeability. And that's, in this case, what we have is we have foreseeability. This was foreseeable, that this particular harm was reasonably likely to occur based on the facts of this unique case.
Well, if you take Mr. Smith's hypothetical that a grocery store owner knows that a customer is going to come at 4 o'clock on a particular day and that they have a spouse who's threatened to kill them, then under those particular circumstances, why does that business not have an obligation to provide protection for that victim?
Because this unique set of facts we have in our case was different than what's suggested in that scenario.
And what case do you point to that there is an obligation to, if there are protocols, that there is an obligation to carry out those protocols?
The Richardson case, Your Honor, which is a Western District case, which you sat on in 2002, is Richardson versus Quick Trip, which is cited in our brief. And also in Aziz, which is an Eastern District case, talks about why those policies or protocols are relevant to the duty. And also it goes to foreseeability. And this case doesn't stand for the proposition that every business owner is the insurer for anybody that comes onto their property for whatever harm that may occur. Here, we have a specific fact scenario where Ms. Whelan goes to her boss on November 6th and tells her boss that she's served with an ex parte order that alleges all these things that her ex-domestic partner is harassing her, intimidating her, and threatening her. She's served with this ex parte order, and she explains to her HR director, that's not what I'm doing to him, that's what he's doing to me. They had a policy in place. They had Team 9, a security team.
But you didn't submit that they had those those protocols and they didn't follow them?
What we submitted on was that it was because they didn't follow those procedures that they failed to foresee this reasonable likelihood.
I don't see that anywhere in the instruction.
Well, Your Honor, if you look at paragraphs 2, paragraph 2nd, where it says defendant knew or by using ordinary care could have known that Alan Lovelace was in the parking lot and posed a danger to the plaintiff.
Again, that's totally focused on danger. That isn't focused on action to protect them against that danger.
Well, what they did in this case is they initiated their protocol. They asked for a description of this gentleman, and then they asked for a photograph. That's where it stopped. Their protocol, had they followed it, went on to say that they needed to pass that around to Team 9. They needed to allow her to have a parking spot up front, in front of the front desk, where they would have his description available. All that does go to ordinary care and goes to foreseeability.
How does that go to ordinary care if, in fact, they didn't have a duty to have protocols or to execute on those protocols?
Once they undertook that duty, Your Honor, then they had an obligation.
Isn't that a different claim of liability? That they undertook to protect the person they told they would, and they failed to do that?
That is, but what we submitted on was that they failed to follow through on protecting her once they knew or could have known. And that's the difference. Like here, they could have known that he was on the property. They knew he was a danger. There's no question about that. That was undisputed in the record. They knew that he was opposed to danger, so yet they didn't follow through on their.
So what do we get a look at? It seems like it comes down to that. That's a key distinction between your two approaches. In deciding what they, by using ordinary care, they could have known that he was on the parking lot and posed a danger. Can we only consider anything they learned after, or they could have learned after he got on the lot? Or can you, what's the basis, I think maybe part of Judge Breckenridge's questions are going to, what gives us the right to consider these prior protocols from deciding what they could have known later on? Is it because since they adopted them, they thought they were reasonable, or is it the cameras that were there?
Well, I believe it goes to the basic law here in Missouri. This is not unique. It goes back to Madden, which was decided in 1988. It's been the law as long as I've been practicing law, that you look at the totality of the circumstances. And it's not just actual knowledge that we have here. We also have constructive knowledge or constructive notice of a danger.
But do you start looking, Mr. Smith's told us that for the specific harm exception, you don't have, if you haven't assumed a duty, then you have to wait till the specific harm is actually presented, and then you look and see if you've acted reasonably after that point. And I think you all agree on that, but you disagree on what evidence we can consider in deciding whether that's been met.
The major disagreement that the parties had at trial was what was relevant before Mr. Lovelace entered the property.
And can you tell us a little bit?
Doesn't that might necessarily go to the legal question about duty?
And I think that is a legal question, whether there is a duty.
Right, and the answer to that question was made by the judge long before this jury instruction was given, correct?
That's correct.
So what might be relevant to the issue of duty and what might be relevant here? I mean, there could be some things that are relevant to both, or there could be some that just apply to duty or just apply to this question.
Well, I think it also goes to whether there's a breach of the duty.
Right.
And that's what we argued, that foreseeability was that they had this policy or protocol in place, and it would have allowed them to have detected Mr. Lovelace on the property.
So absent that protocol, would there be liability?
Well, it depends on the circumstances of the case, Your Honor. Like if that, I think in this case, had they not had this protocol, that's a good question. But we were focused on the specific facts of this case.
And were they compelled to have the protocol?
They were not compelled to have a protocol.
And were they compelled to implement the protocol?
I believe they were, based upon their own policies.
And if they weren't compelled to have it, why were they compelled to implement it?
Because the majority of the workforce at OOSI is female. They've had domestic threats in the past. They were aware of the danger of domestic threats. That's why they implemented this policy, to protect the people there on their property because of past experiences. That's why they formed Team 9.
You're kind of addressing as an assumed duty there, though, aren't you? Mixing the two.
I'm not sure it's an assumed duty, but I think if we just look generally at traditional tort language, not getting into the exceptions of that Mr. Smith addressed.
But you're also looking at prior similar incidents, which, again, is a different claim, a different submission, and you didn't submit on that, and you didn't. So it has different elements than the specific harm.
We did not submit on prior similar incidents, Your Honor.
I thought you were arguing that the specific harm that could have known is that for whatever reason they had it, they had cameras and they chose not to man them, and that once they knew or could have known he was on the property, did they use ordinary care? Well, he was there for an hour, and if anybody looked at the cameras, they would have seen it, and that's what you're saying occurred after he injured the property.
Not only that, Your Honor, not only the cameras were not monitored. That was unknown to Ms. Whelan. That was known to the company, but not Ms. Whelan. But
did they tell her they were monitoring the cameras?
No.
Did they have an obligation to monitor the cameras?
They put the cameras up. I think they had an obligation.
Whelan, why do they have an obligation?
Well, I'm not sure they had an obligation to monitor them, but I think they're assuming a duty once they put them up, and to provide the false sense of security to people on the property.
If we rule the way you're suggesting, aren't we making sure that no businesses will take any safety precautions?
Exactly.
I mean, we're telling them don't do anything, because if you do, you will be obligated because they could have helped.
I think it's exactly the opposite of that, Your Honor. Because if companies are implement or they develop policies, we don't want them, as a matter of public policy, to be hollow. We want them, if they say that it's a safe place because we do X, Y, and Z, we want them to follow through on it.
But doesn't the assumed duty have different elements?
Well, I think, again, what we submitted under instruction number 6, I think that it wasn't like an assumed duty, but I think under traditional tort approach, we're looking at whether there was a duty as a matter of law, right? And what LAC stood for is that we're not going to get into the fray of going through a prior similar incidents or specific harm or a balancing test. What it says, we don't want to enter that fray and adopt one particular case. We look at the totality of the circumstances of that case.
Counsel, let's look at this, and let's say there's no Team 9, there are no monitors, but the employee comes with a photograph of the husband, okay, and warns the employer of the possible harm. Does that create a duty without all the rest of this? She says, I'm scared, I think I'm in danger here while I'm at work, here's a photograph of my a possible assaulter, husband in this case. Where is the law with respect to duty there? Let's get rid of all the rest of this Team 9, et cetera.
Right. I think what the law says under Madden and LAC and Richardson and all the other cases is you look at the totality of the circumstances and what is foreseeable. That would create the duty there. What is the totality of the circumstances under the special facts of that particular case? Now, just that hypothetical alone, I'm not sure that would be enough.
So what if we don't agree with your totality of circumstances test, and we think there are these separate tests? Then do you lose or do you win under the specific harm exception also?
Plaintiff the respondent would still prevail under this special facts and circumstances exception. This is not new law, Your Honors. This case followed what the Aziz opinion set forth. Our instruction was exactly like the Aziz instruction are very similar. It was tailored after Aziz.
But isn't there a big difference between requiring a response to danger that's there and requiring an obligation to that was they failed to call the police or tell the people who were the danger to leave.
To disperse, yeah.
And isn't that different? Isn't there a distinction between that and having to take actions to prepare for or anticipate danger as these safety protocols?
Your Honor, I think the very reason why they had those protocols is because they were aware that this domestic situation such as this could lead to danger.
Sometimes,
just like in these.
As opposed to you've got an actual danger on your property at that time.
Well, in Aziz, what you're referring to is they were aware that loitering in the parking lot could lead to danger, which in the Aziz case it eventually did. After some time, after they failed to ask them to disperse, after they failed to call the security company to come, it did lead to danger. Similar to here, had they allowed her to park up front in view of the front desk, escorted her to her car like they did pursuant to protocol, and called law enforcement said they could have increased patrols had they been aware of this danger. That was in the record. That was evidence. The police department was right across the street from here. They did none of that.
Well, but in Aziz, if we take your argument here, aren't you saying that if there were people loitering, they had an obligation to go out and walk people from their cars into the building so they weren't injured?
Well, they had in Aziz, they did have a specific policies and company policies as to what to do. First was ask them to disperse. If they didn't, they remained. They were aware that could lead to danger. Then the second part of that was to go to call the security company to come. Just as in here, what we submitted on, Your Honor, you're right, we did not submit on the Hoover Dairy theory. But it's analogous to that because they did have this protocol in place and they failed to follow it, which would have prevented it. That's the foreseeability which creates the duty.
But the difference is in Aziz, they saw the actors there, then the policy kicked in. Here, it's a policy before they actually see the actors.
Here, when the human resources director requests the description and requests the photograph and then says that they will hand it out to Team 9, that's when it kicked in.
That was before he arrived on the premises.
That is before he arrived on the premises, but it goes to foreseeability, which is the touchstone for duty.
Any other questions?
Is that reflected? Do you think that's reflected in the jury instruction?
I believe what we submitted in instruction number 6 was based upon the evidence that was presented in the record. Yes, Your Honor.
Thank you, Counsel.
Thank you.
Counsel, in paragraph 2, there are two things going on. Newark could have known that he was present. Newark could have known that he posed a danger, correct?
Right.
Mr. Bethune says that the evidence on the second, on a known dangerous person, was uncontested, and everybody agrees that that's correct. Do you agree with that characterization?
Yes, I agree that the shooter was known to be dangerous, if that's your question.
And what is the evidence that satisfies that part of paragraph 2?
Paragraph.
How was it that the employer knew or could have known that he posed a danger to the victim?
I believe it would be from what was provided by the Ms. Weiland to the employer
prior to when he came on into the parking lot, correct?
Of course. We've never denied that.
Why can we consider evidence from the past on that issue of dangerousness, but you tell me we can't consider evidence from the past on the question of whether he was there on the parking lot? Does it seem logical that I have two different tests in the same sentence?
No, I don't think it's two different tests at all. With all due respect, Your Honor, here's the reason why. This is about duty. What you're talking about is the information that might later establish duty. So you could have information that somebody is known danger. In my example of the Joneses in my small grocery store in Savannah, we readily admit that there will be times when you will know somebody's dangerous based on something that happened before. But the trigger for when to act comes after they're on the premises and you could have known they're there. It's not that you could have known they were dangerous, but you know that they pose a danger then to the victim.
What can we consider in deciding if you could have known if they're there?
All right. Again, I'm saying that you can't put could have known in this vast universe because that's outside the SH exception. That the only thing under your law, and LAC did not do what Mr. Bethune says it did. It did not adopt the totality of the circumstance. In fact, what it said is, we don't want to get into that phrase. So I would ask each of you to read LAC again and understand it doesn't say that. But my point in answering this question is, when is the duty to act? And under the SH exception, the duty to act comes after you knew or could have known based on the circumstances that existed at the time. Because if you don't keep it in this SH exception for COD box, if you adopt what Mr. Bethune wants you to, do away with the no duty rule. It's silly. We shouldn't even be talking about exceptions if he's right.
Why do we have could have known in there? Because you don't give it any meaning.
You know, I should have listened to Ms. Kennedy. She said, I know what your argument is, and I think it's a just argument that's right, but it may imply that it's the vast universe. Well, I said, I know it isn't. But the point is, it's still when you judge the sufficiency of the evidence. And think about this, Your Honors. Mr. Bethune, when he was up here, argued three different breaches. Three. Failure to follow the protocol. That's an assumption of the duty. The failure to notify Tech 9 or whatever it was. He argued three different theories, and he did that at trial. You know why? Because at trial, the three theories they pled were still afloat. They were still afloat, and the trial judge kept telling me they don't have to elect until it's the instruction conference. I said, fine. But think about how confusing this is going to be to the jury if they don't submit on all three. Trial judge said, well, it is what it is. So then they get to the end of the trial and they select the SH exception, and I frankly was so happy because I knew they couldn't meet that burden. In this box, there was nothing that had caused them to have a duty to act before he got there. And regardless of how you look at this case, Aziz doesn't match up like they say anything. That what you have to look at is if you want to impose a duty on my client to have monitored those cameras 24/7, to put in extra patrols. You heard what he said up here. That's what he argued at trial. If you want to do that to business owners in the state of Missouri, adopt a general foreseeability test, do away with the no-duty rule, do away with these exceptions. But one thing I want to point out to you, and before I have to sit down, and that's on page 6, right there at the top, each NDR exception has a separate and distinct factual test for establishing a duty of care, the bedrock of which is the foreseeability. Mr. Bethune would have you believe that my SHS exception, yours and LAC, doesn't take into account foreseeability. Wrong, wrong, and wrong. It is still the bedrock. But what you have said is we will limit the liability of businesses in this state for the criminal acts of third parties by adopting a special foreseeability test and the underlying facts that have to be found by a jury in order for this liability to attach. I urge you to keep the no-duty rule. Well, on behalf of all businesses in this state, I urge you to limit their duty because otherwise we're going to have the Savannah Grocery Store case back up here or Herzog or whatever that has these big parking lots. So I think the law is clear. I think we operated with the law, but I think they were allowed to argue and present evidence that were on theories that were never presented to the jury. And the bedrock, as far as I know, in this state is a jury cannot return a verdict on a theory that wasn't pled or submitted to them. And by the way, don't forget the second issue where they argued 38 times a breach of a duty that's nowhere in instruction number 6. And I don't know how a trial judge can let somebody argue a breach of duty not even instructed upon. With that, you've been very, very patient with me, Mr. Chief Justice. I appreciate that, and I appreciate the time of the court. And I certainly apologize for not being able to give you a very exciting slideshow. Thank you.
So well argued.